Today now we began a very, very sad and tragic chapter in the life of God's people in the Old Testament. We've already seen the decline and the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. And today we will see now the judgment that befalls the southern kingdom of Judah. And then the prophets that attend to that event, namely Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And then also God's continued presence and providence to his people in exile in Babylon. And his word to them from Jeremiah and Ezekiel and also Daniel. Okay, well, let's begin with the history here, first of all, understanding the historical context of this. And really this covers the time period from about 605 to 586 BC when we're talking about the fall of Judah. 605 will be the first deportation, and 586 will be the final deportation of people from Judah. And that would also be the occasion of the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. The period that we're really speaking of now here is primarily this time period, beginning about 609, going to 587, 586 here, okay? And we saw yesterday the end of Josiah in 609. What you have at this time now is conflict between Mesopotamia and Egypt with Judah caught in the middle, okay? And the dominating juggernaut in terms of a world power for the last century or so has been the Assyrians and Nineveh here. And in fact, it was the Assyrians that conquered the northern kingdom of Israel and took the 10 tribes captive, dispersed them throughout the Assyrian Empire. And so this is quite a superpower. But now here at the end of the 7th century, okay, so you're talking about the 600s, BC, you have the decline of Assyria. Assyria pretty much overextended itself and just kind of burnt out after a while. And you have other nations now seeking dominance in the region. And especially the nations that will seek dominance are Babylon and Egypt. Okay? And so these two are wrestling for the next chapter of world domination, primarily Babylon and Egypt, and caught in the middle will be Judah, okay, and Jerusalem. So what you have here is in 609, Egypt comes up to do battle actually with Babylon, and Josiah goes out to fight the Egyptians. Why he did that when they were really already kind of, they had already bypassed Jerusalem and were ready in the northern territory here, that's not quite sure, in, at least in my studies here. But Josiah is killed, and so now his successor is his son Jehoahaz, and very soon after that, then Jehoiakim, another son. Okay, Jehoahaz doesn't live very long. There are then three deportations to Babylon. The first one takes place in 605 BC. And it's a fairly insignificant deportation. I'll describe it here shortly. But It does include some of the most promising young people of the land. Essentially, the best of the young people are taken as kind of a surety to make sure that Judah will remain vassal to Babylon. Okay, so this is the time when Daniel and his three friends, who are later named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are taken to Babylon. The second deportation will be in 597, and this will be a time when the king, Jehoiachin, is taken to Babylon, and many of the noble, the leaders, okay, the skilled workmen, the educated leaders, and so forth are taken. And so it's also at this time that Ezekiel is taken to Babylon. And then the final deportation, the one that was most massive, is in 587 with the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, so let's take a look at these again. First of all, we've already seen the earlier deportation from the northern kingdom to Assyria. Okay, and then we've got these subsequent ones here. The first deportation takes place in 605 BC, and it is occasioned by what we call the Battle of Carchemish. Carchemish is up here, and this was really the decisive battle that now that nails the final nail in the coffin of the Assyrian Empire and establishes Babylon as the world power, okay? And Nineveh is still trying to, Assyria is still trying to hold on. Nineveh actually was destroyed in 512 BC, but there's still remnants of the Assyrian Empire that are holding out. And so this is the last battle between the Babylonians and the Assyrians, and it's up here in Carchemish. The Egyptians now, who again are trying to position themselves against the Babylonians, become allies with the Assyrians. So the Egyptians come up to fight with the Assyrians against the Babylonians, and it's a decisive battle. The Babylonians win. So now it's very clear that the Babylonians are going to take over as the next world power, dominating empire. The Egyptians then flee back to Egypt after the battle, and the Babylonians pursue them into Palestine and in fact take captive then Judah. And Judah had essentially aligned itself with Egypt at this time, okay? And Nebuchadnezzar is actually the general, and but what happens is that right when they are taking possession of Judah, the king of Babylon dies, okay? His name is Nabopolassar. And so Nebuchadnezzar must quickly return back to Babylon in order to consolidate his throne. As he does so then, he takes a few of the younger, promising, stellar people from Judah as kind of a surety to make sure that the people of Judah, the king, behaves and so forth. Okay.
And does he then leave Babylonian soldiers in Judah, I would assume, or not? Are they occupied?
No, not. They are to give tribute, okay. But the threat here is, you behave or I'll be back, okay. So they're not really occupied. And so actually what happens now again is the king, whose name is Jehoiakim, who really becomes Jeremiah's nemesis. I mean, there's just a bad blood between him and Jeremiah, as we'll see here. Jehoiakim is vacillating. He's always vacillating between, should I continue to submit to the Babylonians, or should I rebel and align myself with the Egyptians still? Because the Egyptians are still quite strong. They've fled, but they're still a power to be reckoned with. And so he's always vacillating between those two. Okay? Well, finally, he decides to rebel against Babylon. And so Babylon has to come back. Okay? And that then takes place in 597. Okay? Actually, during the siege of Jerusalem, Jehoiakim here dies. And so his son, Jehoiachin, or Keen, N there, we'll just call him Jehoiachin to keep it clear. Jehoiachin then takes over. And, you know, it's kind of like, thanks a lot, Dad, you rebelled, and then the Babylonians came and besieged the city, and then you die, leaving it up to me now to deal with the siege. Okay? Well, eventually then he submits to Babylon and is deported along with Judah's best, brightest and best, the skilled workmen, the educated people, educated leaders, and so forth. And Ezekiel is one of those. In this deportation, 10,000 Judahites are taken away to Babylon. So it's a much more significant deportation than the one that was earlier in 605. And Babylon places upon Judah a heavy tribute that needs to be paid. Okay, so you've got another 10 years, and the successor here named Zedekiah, the next king of Judah, he eventually decides also to rebel because he aligns with the Egyptians, with Pharaoh Hoprah. And so again, the Babylonians come back. Nebuchadnezzar besieges the city. And the siege lasts for 2.5 years. And as it's described in the scriptures in 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, and even some of the prophetic writings, Lamentations describes this as well. This was a horrific scene for the people in Jerusalem besieged. Okay, so you understand now, they're in this city. Babylonian armies are around them for 2.5 years. There's no food coming in. So there's massive starvation going on. People resort to eating leather, eating their pets, even to cannibalism, okay? Eating their own children. And eventually then there's a breach in the wall, not so much so that the Babylonians can get in, but so that the royal family and the army can get out and flee. So they breach the wall, and the royal family flees, the army as well. But Zedekiah, the king, is captured near Arabia, and he then is forced to watch his family, his children, killed before his eyes. And just to make sure that's the last thing he sees, then they put out his eyes. And so this is the picture of that taking place, although it's not historically accurate because it would have taken place not in the city, but out in the country near Arabia. Okay? So Zedekiah then is also taken captive to Babylon. Jerusalem then is razed. It's destroyed. The temple is destroyed. Okay, and that's again the picture that you have here. The population is deported en masse. I mean, already a significant number have died just from the starvation and disease during the siege, and then a significant number killed during the taking of the city. But those that are left then are taken off to captivity in Babylon, except for the very poorest of the poor who are left behind. Jeremiah is left behind, okay? He is taken captive, but when they recognize who he is, and all the while Jeremiah had been saying, submit to the Babylonians. The Babylonians are God's instrument now. Submit to them. The Babylonians somehow became aware of that, and so they released Jeremiah. Unfortunately, that wasn't the end of his troubles, though. So in 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 21, it says, so Judah went into captivity away from her land. Okay. So 2 Kings and also 2 Chronicles ends with the fall of Jerusalem and the people being carried off to captivity. But each of these historical books ends also with a slight glimmer of hope. Okay? And in 2 Kings, after describing the deportation and how Jehoiachin had been taken to Babylon, actually he was taken 10 years earlier, but he's still alive there, and it says he is released. This is a hopeful message because he is of the line of David. And so now there is still hope for the reestablishment of the monarchy. And it still is evidence that God is keeping true to his covenant with David of the dynasty, the royal dynasty. Okay? So that's the hopeful light that is shown at the end of this dark chapter at the end of 2 Kings. In 2 Chronicles, you have a fast forward to the end of the exile and a reference then to Cyrus's edict. Cyrus, who is the conqueror on behalf of the Persians and the Medes, who takes then over essentially the Babylonian Empire and gives permission for the Jews to return to their land. So that's the hopeful note that is rung at the end of 2 Chronicles. Okay? So, that's the essential historical narrative, but now we're going to plug into that the prophets who are most relevant to this time period. And the first prophet is Jeremiah, okay? And his ministry here is approximately 626 to 582, so about 40 years before the fall of Jerusalem itself, he begins his ministry, and it continues even after the fall of Jerusalem in 587, 586. Okay. Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet, and with good reason. We know very little about most of the prophets in terms of their personal lives. What's important is the message, and that's what's been recorded and is conveyed to us. We do catch a few tidbits now and then about the prophets. For example, Amos. If you remember, what are some of the personal characteristics of Amos? Do you remember? Okay, he's from the country. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's right. So he's from Tekoa and was a shepherd and a dresser of figs. So a little bit about him. Micah.
Contemporary of Isaiah.
What's that?
Contemporary of Isaiah.
Contemporary of Isaiah.
He was also from the country.
Also from the country, more rural. Okay. What do we know about Isaiah himself? His personal life.
Well, he had access to the temple. He was Levite, and didn't you also say a line of Aaron?
Okay, a priest, that's right. So the line of Aaron was a priest, had access into the temple where he had that vision, okay? And yet he also had access to the palace, to royalty, okay? Any other personal information about Isaiah you remember? Okay, he's married, and she's referred to as a prophetess, and also had children, so he was a family man, okay? So, of course, with Hosea, we get quite a bit of the personal information because his personal life is the message, okay? It's the dramatization of the message, in effect. With Jeremiah, his life is very much open to us. We know more about him personally than any other prophet. And not only do we know about his happenings in his personal life, but we know about his interior life because he kind of wears his emotions on his sleeve. He expresses kind of what's inside of him, what's on his heart. And much of that is sorrow and grief, and that's why he's called here the weeping prophet. Okay? Sometimes parts of his writings are referred to as the confessions. Of Jeremiah, because they convey much of these innermost thoughts and even some of the struggles he has with God and complaints that he has with Yahweh. So again, he's very transparent in that regard, and that is somewhat unique. Okay, Jeremiah also comes from a priestly background, priestly family. He originates in Anathoth. Okay. This is a town that is north of Jerusalem, and it's a priestly town, a Levitical town, but it is noteworthy in Old Testament history because it was where the priests who were the priestly line that was essentially rejected by Solomon, okay, they were then sent there to live. So they're priests who were a bit disenfranchised from the time of Solomon. And this is the background that we have of Jeremiah. Jeremiah's ministry, using the timeline here then, begins around 626, but continues even beyond the destruction here. So it's starting here, but goes all the way down. Jeremiah continues the classical approach and method of the prophets in that he bases his message upon the covenant God had made with Israel a long time ago and how that covenant had been broken. And so his message is primarily one of judgment, which is typical of what we've seen here with the pre-exilic prophets. Okay, typically judgment and the announcement that God will bring Babylon to be his instrument here to carry out judgment upon Jerusalem and Judah. Okay, God calls him in a noteworthy way, and it's important for you to recognize here the way God calls Jeremiah, as with others. And we have here a depiction of some of the different calls, each of which, I should note, are potential questions on the exam for any of these. Okay? So, call of Moses with the burning bush. That narrative, God directly calls him to be the deliverer. The call of Joshua by God directly, the commander of the armies of the Lord appears to Joshua, calls him to carry out this mission of the conquest. In each of these cases, Moses and Joshua are directed to remove their sandals because they are standing before the holy God and on holy ground. Then you have the call of Samuel. Remember when the young boy was sleeping in the tabernacle area there? God comes to him, calls him. Yesterday we saw the call of Isaiah, and Isaiah being transported into the heavenly throne room, the cherubim or seraphim flying around, and how the coal was touched upon his lips to purify him for his ministry of prophecy. Today then we'll take a look at two other prophets and their calls by God. This represents Jeremiah, and this represents then Ezekiel. And again, both of these are fair game for the exam coming up. With Jeremiah here, the call comes in chapter 1. So if you will please turn to Jeremiah chapter 1 so we can take a look at that call. Jeremiah chapter 1. And verse 3, or 4, I'm sorry. Now the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations." In other words, I had elected you, selected you for this even before you were born. "Then I said," this is Jeremiah's response, "Ah, Lord God, behold, I do not know how to speak, for I'm only a youth. But Yahweh said to me, 'Do not say I am only a youth, for to all to whom I send you, you shall go, and whatever I command you, you shall speak. Do not be afraid of them, for I am with you to deliver you, declares the Lord.'" So, just as we've seen with others who protest, "I'm not able, I'm incapable of being your servant." Think of Moses at the burning bush here. Isaiah, "Woe to me, I am a man of unclean lips." So here Jeremiah says, "I'm too young, I'm youthful." And the Lord says, "I'm going to use you anyway." Verse 9, "Then Yahweh put out his hand and touched my mouth. And the Lord said to me, 'Behold, I have put my words in your mouth. See, I have set you this day over nations and over kingdoms to pluck up and tear, break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant.'" And so again, this is a beautiful demonstration of that primary role that the prophets have of being Yahweh's mouthpiece. And Yahweh himself touches the mouth of Jeremiah and says, "I'm putting my words into your mouth so that what you speak will be what I am saying to the people. You are my instrument." But what will that message be? Verse 10, "To pluck up, tear down, destroy, to overthrow." It's primarily judgment, destruction, overthrowing, the destruction of Judah, but also to build and plant. There will be hope. And especially in the section of Jeremiah, chapters 30 to 33, we have some beautiful oracles of hope, of promise, of God's deliverance and restoration of his people and of the new covenant. So this will be his message as well. Okay, as I said before, Jeremiah then carries out his ministry, and he has a lot to say. Jeremiah is a long book, So you can see it's 52 chapters and a lot of words. So we do have a lot extant of what Jeremiah has said. And no doubt much of that is to the credit of his faithful companion and scribe, Baruch.
Did Baruch, is that the Baruch that wrote the Apocalypse of Baruch?
The association is with him, okay. The Apocalypse of Baruch is a pseudepigraphal writing, okay. So it's attributed to this Baruch, okay. It's the same Baruch, but it's not him. It's pseudepigraphal, which means false writing. Someone much later wrote it and attributed it to Baruch to get more, I guess, authority, have it authorized by an ancient person. So, right. Okay. Baruch is one of the few friends that Jeremiah has. And Jeremiah has a very, very difficult life. He is quite an outsider, and part of that's the reason why he's the weeping prophet. He is attacked by priests. He's attacked by his own hometown folk, his own family. His brothers plot to kill him, to snuff him out. Okay. He is outcast. He is rejected. About his only friends are Baruch here and a guy by the name of Shaphan. Shaphan, who appears in the narrative of 2 Kings as well, as the one who oversaw the renovation of the temple in the time of Josiah. So this Shaphan, who seems to be a very faithful man, recognizes in Jeremiah the true prophet of the Lord. Okay? So he's got few friends and many, many enemies. One of the nicknames that is given to Jeremiah is, Hebrew is Megar Misabib, which means terror on every side. So it's kind of like they're saying, wherever he goes, there's trouble. And the picture that I have is, I don't even know if it's still, I haven't seen it recently. There used to be a comic strip called Little Abner. Any of you ever, maybe some of the older of us remember Little Abner. And there's this little old guy, bent over, who always had this dark cloud over his head, and it was always raining on him. Wherever he went, there was just this dark cloud, and he's kind of bent over and trouble wherever he goes. And that's the nickname here that Jeremiah has. Okay? And it's a heavy burden that the Lord places upon him. In fact, Jeremiah calls his ministry a burden. And he says, I'd love to get out of it. Okay, he says, God, what did you get me into? I didn't ask for this. I didn't ask for all this trouble. But you appointed me, you called me to this. It's kind of no fair, God. And yet this is what you called me to, so I will continue to be faithful to this calling. At one point, Jeremiah even says, cursed be the day that I was born. We saw in the call here, God said, even before you were born, I set you apart. And Jeremiah says, essentially, I wish I wasn't born, because the burden of ministry and of carrying this message to the people is so difficult. I think this is really something that is laudable and commendable about Jeremiah. Please turn in chapter 9, and you see some of this grief that he expresses in the burden that he carries. If you even go back up to chapter 8, verse 18, he says, my joy is gone. grief is upon me. My heart is sick within me. But then skip down to chapter 9. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. Oh, that I had in the desert a traveler's lodging place, that I might leave my people and go away from them, for they are all adulterers, a company of treacherous men. They bend their tongue like a bow. Falsehood and not truth has grown strong in the land, for they proceed from evil to evil, and they do not know me, declares the Lord. Note that for something that we'll hear later here. They do not know me, declares Yahweh. Okay. Yet, so just this grief, this sorrow of carrying this message. But the key to seeing here is that it says, the very end there, declares the Lord, declares Yahweh. Jeremiah here is a reflection of the heart of God. God's heart is breaking. He is grieving over the sin of the people and their turning away. This is breaking God's heart. He is in sorrow over this. And so as the mouthpiece of Yahweh, this weeping prophet is also showing the grief of Yahweh over the broken covenant and the divorce that is coming about with his beloved Judah, who has betrayed him. Okay?